Ahoy, mateys. Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is April 15th, 2017, and this is episode number... I don't know, because my browser window just froze.
The magic of live radio. So this is GameBuoy Podcast, episode 135. A GameBuoy Live look at Breath of the Wild.
Thank you so much for your help there, Slagkick. I really appreciate that.
Hey, I guess I'm good for something sometimes.
Holy moly, whoever would have guessed?
So, yeah, this is our kind of annual live episode. We've done a couple of them, and we're excited to be here. Thank you to those of you who are joining us in chat. We have Sulker, Your Enzyme, JD, and Bisselbee. We hope that you are looking forward to a spoilerific Zelda discussion. Just a little warning there.
Yeah, we do intend to discuss every aspect of this new modern masterpiece that we certainly can. That having been said, until my show notes start responding to me, this is probably going to sound a little weird. But let's dig in to our follow-ups and news bits. That'll give me a good moment's reprieve from needing my notes. Slaggy, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, so a lot of our follow-ups and news bits today are coming from the Nintendo Direct that aired a few days ago, and the first follow-up that we have is that we finally have release information for the Bayonetta, Corrin, and Cloud amiibo. They will be available on July 21st, and we'll have both of the looks, so like both Bayonetta looks and both Cloud designs, and male and female Corrin.
In addition, that's really exciting about these Player 2 variants, as they're being described, is like the Cloud version, the alternate, is actually going to be like the Advent Children appearance, which I think is really awesome. The Bayonetta one, of course, is
Bayo2.
I'm just super into this. I think it's really awesome.
Yeah, some of these are retailer exclusive. I am not sure which retailers have which ones, so you'll have to look into that yourself. In addition, we have three new Link amiibo. There's going to be Majora's Mask, Ocarina of Time, and Twilight Princess amiibo on June 23rd. So please look forward to that.
Your Enzyme is in chat noting the Booby HD rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Indeed, we sure are.
We have news that the Switch in the first month of March sold 906,000 units in North America alone. So already off to a really good start. This also comes with the news that Breath of the Wild, just for Switch, sold 925,000 copies. And you're not hearing that wrong. I did not read that wrong. That means that there was over 100% attach rate, which means probably some people got it as a collector's edition and just got another copy or something. Or they got a copy and weren't able to get a Switch or something like that.
Hooray, my notes have begun responding again.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, you know, another thing that I haven't seen a lot of people talk about is I actually know within my life more than four people who bought copies of Zelda for Switch, but that have been unable to find Switches in retail channels so far. So that may also contribute to that number.
Well, it's nice that it's like a good faith purchase, I guess you could say.
Indeed.
And also, 460,000 copies sold for Wii U. So, hey, when the Wii U has titles that people want to buy, people buy them.
Yeah, and you know, that's something really cool about that to me is that, you know, the game was announced long ago now, as we will talk about. It was announced for Wii U, of course. A lot of people thought that Nintendo would cancel the Wii U SKU. I'm really glad they went through with it, and by all accounts, the performance on the Wii U version is actually, you know, roughly comparable to the performance of the Switch release. So, really happy that, you know, those players who were waiting for that did end up getting catered to by Nintendo, and they got a product that was of acceptable quality.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just really happy for the game selling well and the Switch selling well. I mean, it's on track to, I mean, hopefully do Wii numbers, but even if not doing Wii numbers, it's off to a really good start. So I'm so glad.
I am always hesitant to say Wii numbers, but right this moment, it is tracking ahead of the Wii,
and
which
like the analysts,
crazy to say.
Yeah, analysts or whatever you call those people are saying that it could do Wii numbers. So, and they're people who paid to work with numbers, right?
Yeah. So you recall that we were a few moments ago talking about Bayonetta amiibo, right?
Yes.
Well, we have another Bayonetta Bayonetta follow-up here, and that is news that the recent teaser posted by Sega Online regarding Bayonetta and the 8-bit Bayonetta game on Steam did end up resolving in Bayonetta releasing on Steam this week.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's something really cool. You know, this game actually appears to be remarkably well-optimized. It does feature support natively for, you know, 4K resolutions. It has a huge suite of advanced graphics options, and it actually runs like super well even on fairly low-end computer systems.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so it really does seem for all intent and purpose to be the new best way to play Bayonetta.
That being said, I think I'm gonna have to spend my tax return on a new gaming PC, or, you know, building my own, because I want to play Bayo in 4K.
Yeah, dude, if you're serious, I would be completely happy to work with you on buying a fancy new computer, or putting together a fancy new computer. Or
excellent.
Fixing the computer you already have.
Yeah. Well, I might not be able to, because I might be spending all my money at the Dangerous Woman concert tour. Okay, that's not really true, but in Dangerous Woman news, we have Dangerous Ariana coming back to Brave Exvius Final Fantasy. There's a little promotion going on where you can win tickets to her Dangerous Woman concert tour. It looks like the deadline for that is April 21st. There's also some sort of community contest. I can't really speak to that because I don't play Brave Exvius, but you can, I believe it's one of those things where if enough people share something on social media, you can get in-game rewards for it.
Oh, that's awesome.
So if you're bravely Exviusing and you don't have Dangerous Ariana yet, you can get another chance to get her.
Your Enzyme in chat has noted that building is fun, which, unless he, like myself, is a Lego enthusiast, and I'm not judging, is remarking on how fun it is to build PCs. Sulker noted from that, LOL, you guys should do an episode about PC gaming and optimizing a build in 2017.
That's not a bad idea at all.
That isn't a bad idea at all. I typically build a new machine every 2 years or so. I'm actually due for a new one right now.
Based on your browser reloading and everything?
Right. I mean, to my credit, or to my machine's credit, I have literally 30 tabs open in this Firefox browser right now.
Oh yeah, my poor little Surface couldn't handle that, but...
But, yeah, no, it actually is time for me to build a new one. So that actually might be really fun. Thanks for the feedback, guys. I will absolutely be taking that into consideration.
Yeah, you know, we can talk about my experience and your experience and different price points and such.
Little tidbits and tips. Anyway,
yeah,
that's an off-air conversation, but it kind of sounds like it's going to happen. I do want to say, though, on this Brave Exvius thing, you know, I was a big fan of Dangerous Ariana as a character. I think it's really cool in, you know, the way that these gachapon-based free-to-play games tend to work. Getting a high-level character that you can, like, do meaningful progression content with can actually be really tricky. So having a guaranteed character who can do that content, who is, like, a powerful character and not just throwaway, is something I think is really good for the game's balance, and I'm really happy to see that this promotion has returned, that people who didn't get Dangerous Ariana previously can get her now, and hopefully we're all going to get a ton of free cool stuff. If you play Brave Exvius, like I do, be sure to participate in this promotion.
Excellent. So we have word from the Pokemon Company that they generated $3.3 billion of revenue last year. That was up from 2015's money of $2.1 billion. This is likely because of Pokemon Go and Sun and Moon being huge last year, to the point where we started a podcast about it with Sulker called Same Type Attack Bonus Podcast, Stabcast.org. Check it out.
Stabcast.org. Check it out. Yeah, I'm, of course, super happy to hear this. I'm a big Pokemon fan, and I think last year was a banner year for the brand. I think
it
was
practically
as big as it had been since the 90s last year.
I mean, the 20th anniversary, I mean, they had to do some big things. So, but yeah, I mean, making that much money, and people are like, oh, Nintendo is going to fail and stuff. Like, with Pokemon in the roster, they're always going to have a moneymaker.
Yeah, there is that. We also have word out of Nintendo that the NES Classic Edition has been discontinued in North America.
Yeah, this almost would go in so controversial if we had other controversial news bits.
Let's see, we have a little bit of feedback in chat. Sulker, of course, says, Pokemon of JD has noted, they really made the most of the 20-year thing. Yeah. To which, of course, I completely agree.
Yeah, your enzyme says, Nintendo, why?
This is, of course, in response to the current news story. Obviously, it's super controversial that Nintendo has discontinued this plug-and-play system. I'm a little sympathetic to Nintendo in that, you know, I get the feeling that this was really just meant to be sort of a holdover to get people to the Switch, get some kind of income coming through the holiday season since they didn't really have anything in North America. That having been said, my sympathy begins and ends there. This is obviously a product people still want. You know, you still go online, find resellers selling these things at crazy scalping prices of, you know, $150, $200, $300. Like, this is a little $60 piece of tech. Like, it's costing Nintendo a fraction of that to produce. They really need to meet the demand.
Yeah, your enzyme says they never once met any kind of demand for it.
And that's absolutely correct. You know, there's still a real thirst and hunger for this product in retail channels, on the consumer level. There's no real good excuse for this product being discontinued.
The NES Classic controller also being discontinued along with this, which you were able to do with Wii U and Wii Virtual Console. So, I mean, for that one, I mean, I guess because the Wii U is gone and the Wii is gone, it kind of makes sense, but that's kind of a bummer, too.
Yeah, I mean, all ships ahead? That's not really a saying. But at this point, you know, it's full steam ahead for the Switch. It really does seem like Nintendo is completely switching over their retail presence to the Switch. But honestly, man, I'm actually pretty upset about the discontinuing of the NES Classic Edition myself. I really wanted one, even if it's just a cool little like desk item, like a paperweight or something. They're so small and cute. I'm also sympathetic. You know, I know that this thing got hacked wide open. It became incredibly easy to hack. You literally just run an EXE while your NES Classic is connected to your computer via a micro USB cable, and bam, you're hacked. You have, you know, hundreds of games on your unit. I get why Nintendo would, you know, want this product out of the retail channels on multiple levels. I just think it's inappropriate.
Yeah. Your Unsam says, the only recent Nintendo product I actually wanted, JD saying, it's not a good sign for if Nintendo does other consoles like this, like a SNES Classic. So, I don't know. Like, consumers are pretty pissed off about this.
Of course, the interesting follow-up to that is that Nintendo has halted Famicom Mini production in Japan. This is, of course, the Japanese product that corresponds to the NES Classic. The thing that's interesting about that, though, is that it's actually implied by Nintendo Japan that production halt is actually temporary and that they might be doing more Famicom Mini in Japan.
Hey, get your hands on a Famicom Mini, then.
Yeah, and, you know, for those of you who are interested in this product, of course, you know, the NES Classic Edition, you might want to just look at a Famicom Mini for the day when it gets hacked. As I understand it, it isn't currently hacked, but I would think that it's probably the same internals. You could flash it with the US Edition firmware at some point, you know, once we get there. Shouldn't have to do all that, though. Should not have to. And I will say the controllers on the Famicom Mini are ridiculously tiny. I saw one in a shop while I was in Japan. I did not buy it because it was the U.S. equivalent of several hundred dollars, but holy mackerel are those controllers tiny. Your enzyme notes, they should have announced Virtual Console for Switch and put the discontinuation of the NES Classic on the end of that announcement. To which I must say I 120% agree. Your enzyme also notes maybe he'll just build a Raspberry Pi for emulators.
Yeah, LOL. those little Raspberry Pis are getting really popular among hobbyists lately. I mean, I guess they always kind of have been, but, you know, as more people see the cool things you can do with them, I've seen them come up with, like, custom little Game Boys and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, that's a great platform for that kind of project, too.
So we have word that Miitopia is finally coming west later this year. This is the kind of evolution of Find Me, I guess you could say, where your Miis can do RPG stuff. So if you're interested in that, that's coming later this year for 3DS.
You know, a lot of this Nintendo news came out of a Nintendo Direct that took place this week. I want to ask, Saigi, did you watch the Nintendo Direct?
I did, the Western one. I didn't see the Japanese one because I don't speak Japanese.
Fair. Overall, what did you think? I saw a lot of criticism online that Nintendo was too focused on the 3DS rather than the Switch. Of course, we did get the spotlight on big upcoming Switch titles like ARMS and Splatoon 2.
My thing was is that I was expecting it just to be about those two things. So the fact that they had a bunch of little headlines before those two big spotlights, I thought it was pretty satisfying. I mean, you know, I'm just happy anytime there's a Direct, pretty much. So, you know.
Excellent. Excellent. All right.
You know, we talked about last time on our last episode that we are, you know, expecting to see 3DS titles continue to be announced at least throughout this year. So, I mean, it's still a system that's very popular and well-supported, so.
Indeed. And your enzyme notes in chat, seems out of place to have a new Mii game come out since Miiverse is dead. You know, while Miiverse, to me, had very little to do with actual Miis, I do agree, 2017, getting a Mii-centric game, a little weird for me.
Yeah, Miitomo kind of is not even on the radar anymore.
And JD notes, I enjoyed the 3DS coverage, and it kind of says to me that they're not done with the system yet. A lot of people have been writing off the 3DS because they see the Switch replacing it, and I don't think Nintendo is there yet. They were announcing release dates through the holiday season.
Yeah, including Monster Hunter Stories is coming west, which looks great. I've been looking forward to that for a long time.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, I completely agree with what JD says here. And, you know, it's kind of like what we saw happen back in the GBA DS switchover, where Nintendo stated that they intended to support both platforms. They did eventually drop the GBA after the DS had shown that it was a reliable platform, that the launch was successful, but they kind of kept the GBA in their back pocket in case that didn't happen. I think that's what we're seeing here. I do think if the Switch continues the numbers that it has had in the last month, that the 3DS's days are numbered, but otherwise, I think they're going to keep it on life support just in case they need to roll back to it, and I think that's a great plan.
And the thing is that the Switch is not a totally handheld, I mean, yes it is, you can hold it in your hands, but I mean, you know, it's still at its core designed to be a home console, I mean, with the battery life and stuff, so, you know, I don't know if they're going to completely get rid of 3DS. I mean, eventually, maybe. Your enzyme says, I think it's just the last bit of games coming to the 3DS. I doubt they'll announce anything for later than 2018. And I mostly agree.
You know, the to me, the wild card there is if they do feel like they need to continue relying on the 3DS for sales, particularly in Western regions, you know, I could see them rolling out more localizations of games that never came over and padding out the release lineup that way for another year. I mean, I actually think that if Nintendo does decide to keep the 3DS alive, they have a lot of ways that they could do that.
The other thing is that they don't really have any competition aside from mobile, because Vita's dead over here.
Well, aside from mobile, as if that isn't massive.
And I mean,
here, it is very much still just number two in Japan.
Yeah, and as far as mobile, Nintendo's got their foot in that door now, so it'll be interesting to see how things shift.
So let's see. Like Slaggy said, Monster Hunter Stories coming west in fall of 2017. But some more really exciting news, not coming out of the Nintendo Direct, of course, is confirmation from Akitoshi Kawazu-san's Twitter feed that they will be bringing the recently announced Romancing Saga 3 remake to Western shores in English. However, he did note there's still working on the Romancing Saga 2 remake to bring that west for Vita. Of course, that's really exciting and makes me glad I still have my Vita, actually.
Yeah, mine's somewhere collecting dust.
Let's see, on that previous discussion, though, your enzyme notes, you don't think they'll just announce a 3DS hardware price drop and some new drops on Evergreen titles? That's how they could easily get more sales without a major investment in new titles on 3DS. And I absolutely do think that would be a valid avenue for them to pursue. Of course, Nintendo's gonna Nintendo, but, you know, like I said, I think there are a lot of things they could do to keep that pillar active if they continue to need that business.
Right.
We also have word here that Overwatch has kicked off a new seasonal event. This one is called Uprising. It's a new PvE mode. It does, of course, have its own exclusive loot crates with new exclusive Overwatch Uprising skins. Sort of the thrust here, you know, it's a PvE map. You're sort of reliving Tracer's first mission.
Yes!
Players get to choose between Tracer, Torbjorn, Reinhardt, and Mercy to defeat waves of robots to liberate the city. Of course, it is on the map King's Row. I've actually been playing this pretty much every night. It's really cool. This is a really well-designed event. I've been having a lot of fun. And something else that's really cool about it is in the arcade mode, there is then also a version of the Uprising mission where you have free selection of all of the game's myriad heroes. So I thought that that was also a really cool change of pace. And, oh, Sulker notes, OMG, the PvE event is so good. Healing on that level is fairly fun.
Yeah,
I haven't healed it yet, but that sounds accurate. I have a lot of fun doing a tank on that map.
I know a lot of people were kind of disappointed that Overwatch didn't have a story mode, so it's nice to see PvE things being introduced like this, and it kind of reminds me of, we'll be talking about Splatoon 2 in a little bit, with their announcement of a sort of PvE sort of mode as well.
Uprising is going to be going forward until May 1st, and your enzyme notes, he wishes there were more variety in Uprising, and the enemies just spawn in the same place every time. And that is a very valid criticism, even though I have been having a lot of fun with it. It does get a little samey. Let's see, last but not least on our follow-ups, we have word here that Lady Layton is now going to be known as Layton's Mystery Journey, and the smartphone version will actually be getting a worldwide simultaneous release on July 20th.
Oh.
And that is, of course, really fun stuff. So, moving forward here, we have our usual slate of release dates. I'm going to dig in with one that has already happened. This past week, on the North American Switch eShop, and actually I believe this is true for the worldwide Switch eShops, the ACA Neo Geo line has now gotten Samurai Showdown 4.
Oh.
This is, of course, super exciting. This is the fourth entry in the Samurai Showdown series. It's actually, in terms of like the narrative of the series and chronology, it takes place between Samurai Showdown 2 and 3, but it's actually like, this is a really great game. You know, some of the hardcores have some problems with Samurai Showdown 3. 2 and 5-0 are probably considered like the best, or I'm sorry, 0 Special or 5 Special as it's also known. That having been said, I think 4 is a great entry point. I also think it's one of the iterations in the series that sort of gets a little less attention with these re-releases typically. So I'm really excited to see that the first Samurai Showdown game to reach the eShop for Switch is Samurai Showdown 4. Saigi, have you played this one yet?
I haven't.
All right, well, we are going to change that after we are done recording this episode.
Excellent. I hope you'll share the joy with me.
Absolutely. We also have word here that RPG Maker Fez will be releasing on 3DS in North America on June 27th. Level 5's upcoming 3DS cross-media RPG project,
wow,
The Snack World,
oh, yeah,
will be releasing in Japan on July 13th. A new Switch game for eShop was stealth announced and released. This is the Skipmore-developed Kamiko. And I have actually already downloaded Kamiko. It is up on the Japanese eShop presently. Went up on April 13th. And it's actually like a really fun throwback Zelda style, almost like Zelda meets a shmup, with like a really cute like 8 to 16 bit art style. It's just a lot of fun. It's like Zelda shmup. It's very plug and play, drop in, have fun. Slaggy, I know you watched me play this a bit last night. What did you think?
It looks really cool. It made me think of what would have happened if Zelda had been developed by HAL Laboratory.
Oh, I think that is a great way to sum it up. Coldcept Revolt for 3DS has finally gotten a North American release date. We will be able to play this fantastic card and board hybrid game on August 29th.
Oh, I bet you're excited for that one.
Dude, I love Coldcept. I'm super stoked. We also have word here that Dragon Quest X, this is of course the MMORPG Dragon Quest title, will be releasing on the Nintendo Switch in Japan this fall.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how MMOs handle on the Switch. We also have word that Minecraft Nintendo Switch Edition will be releasing on May 11th. It will be available on the eShop that day, with a physical version launching later. And it will include the Super Mario Mashup Pack that was quite popular on the Wii U iteration.
Yeah, I think it might be finally time for me to give this Minecraft thing a try.
Yeah, I will
see what the children are talking about. talking about.
I will definitely buy this. I primarily play Minecraft on PC, but having it on a portable console would be fantastic. We also have word that Rayman Legends Definitive Edition will be releasing in 2017. It will support two consoles connecting for local co-op multiplayer.
Oh, cool.
Which has me hoping that the really cool co-op mode from the Wii U version, where one player would use the gamepad to, like, interact with the environment, and then the other player had to speedrun through the levels while their partner was holding open doors and stuff for them. I hope that makes a return, because that was such a fun mode to play in that game, and it would be a really big shame to lose it. We also have word that Payday 2 is coming to the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of people come for this announcement, because Payday 2, an older game, but last month it had almost 50,000 unique users on Steam. Like, while the game is not known for getting all of the current content updates on console releases that the PC version gets, you know, the developers of the game have noted that the Switch version will be getting updates. Whether they hold to that or not, we'll see. But definitely a potentially interesting release for the Nintendo Switch. Definitely something I wasn't expecting. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yeah, your enzyme says, boo, Payday 2. And on the Minecraft tip says, LOL, I've bought Minecraft on everything but PC, LOL. Too many LOLs. I was LOLing the whole time. Sulker says, I've only ever passingly played that game, but watching people build things is fascinating to me. Sulker, we should all pick it up and have some
Minecraft
Nintendo
build party.
Mario building fun.
We also have word here that Yo-Kai Watch 2 Psychic Spectres will be releasing in North America in fall of 2017. This is, of course, like the third version, the Pokemon Crystal, if you think of that generation of Yo-Kai Watch games. And,
that's cool, because I missed out on bony spirits and fleshy souls or whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah. Your enzyme notes, the devs of Payday said that the PS3 and 360 version of Payday 2 would get updates, and they never did. That is absolutely true, which is, of course, why I'm somewhat dubious on their claim that the Switch version will get all the updates, but they are claiming it, so at this point, that's all we have to go on. We also have word here that ARMS will be releasing on June 16th, 2017.
I can't wait.
Aw, yeah, dude, I had so much fun playing ARMS a few months ago at the Nintendo Switch preview tour. Cannot wait to have the full game.
And they announced the new fighter Min Min, who is a ramen girl.
Yes, she is fierce. I love her. I can't wait to play.
I'm loving these new IP, like Splatoon and ARMS. Nintendo's just really hitting it out of the park with this one.
Well, and speaking of Splatoon 2, which in my head will always and forever be Splatoon, will be releasing July 21st, 2017.
Oh, also super stoked.
Ever Oasis, the upcoming JRPG for Nintendo 3DS, will be releasing in North America on June 23rd. That was a surprise to me because, you know, I feel like we haven't really heard a lot about this game since it was announced. It's been a little bit off my radar, and to see it get a release date that is soon, for me, is really exciting.
Yeah.
We also have word that Bye Bye Box Boy is releasing in North America.
It already did, yeah.
Yeah, it actually released that day, which super exciting.
Don't you love when they're like, available now on the eShop?
Dude.
You're like, yes, come through.
Right? I love Box Boy. I think it's a really great series. Fantastic, delightful new little IP. And,
speaking of the brilliance of HAL Laboratories.
Yeah, seriously. I just hope, you know, I know they're calling this one Bye Bye Box Boy, Sayonara Box Boy. I really hope we get another Box Boy game for Switch.
Yeah.
It's not a game that I feel really requires anything on the 3DS that is exclusive to the 3DS. So, to me, bring it over. And while I'm at it, like, hey, guys, can we get a new Dylan's Rolling Western for Switch? Because that's another one I'm not ready to see go away.
Aw, Dylan. Your enzyme says, I'm worried that ARMS won't have any longevity, but I'm a negative Nancy.
You know, I feel the way about ARMS that I feel about every fighting game, and that is to say, I really think it's just going to depend on what adoption by the community looks like. It does have, you know, online play. Obviously, it's going to be lots of fun head-to-head with your bros. I just hope Nintendo supports it. I hope that there are, like, DLC fighters as, like, free updates, and maybe premium updates after a point, but I really hope that...
Yeah, I mean, Splatoon really took off, so, I mean, yeah. I'm thinking that arms, a lot of people will be drawn to it. I know a lot of people are really hyped for it just because it's unique and has a great visual appeal.
Well, I promise this isn't a read of your enzyme. I promise. I would not read our listeners. But I do have to note, Slaggy, remember back before Splatoon released and everyone thought it was going to flop? People thought it was going to be like, oh, this thing's going to sell like 20,000 units and die. And then it turned out to literally reinvigorate console gaming in Japan.
Yeah,
that first Splatoon game has still sold more copies than something like Final Fantasy 15 did.
Wow.
Yeah, right? So, I don't know. I'm really interested in where ARMS goes, because I think Nintendo's tapping into that same kind of design philosophy that they took with Splatoon.
Yeah, Sulker stated, also having played ARMS, I think it's got some good nuances that can be explored. Also pondering if Boxboy will die at the end and it will be the darkest game on Nintendo. I hope Boxboy doesn't die. I would cry.
Indeed. Did we get this JD comment?
No, JD says I never heard of it, but tried the demo and it looks like a lot of fun. I'm guessing, is that about Boxboy?
I assume so. Yeah, if you haven't played any of the Boxboy games, I highly recommend you check it out. Really good stuff. Your enzyme noting a third-person brawler mode for ARMS a la Tobal 2. First off, Tobal is a great series that doesn't get nearly enough credit. Haters gonna hate, I don't care. I'd be so into that. And JD noting, yeah, Boxboy 3DS demo has all three games in it. A bit.
That's cool.
That's awesome, yeah. If you dig it, I strongly recommend you check the full games out.
Do we know, is there like a bundle that you can save if you buy all three of them?
I don't know. There really should be. We have word that the upcoming 2D
Boxboy
Pikmin
box
game
set
for 3DS will be available on July 28th. In North America, and it is now titled Hey Pikmin.
Oh, that looks so good.
And it's going to launch alongside a new Pikmin amiibo.
Oh, I'm so excited. I didn't expect that one to be out so soon. Like, yeah. There's going to be so many good summer games.
Dude, right? We have word here that Yakuza Kiwami will be releasing on PS4 August 29th, 2017. For those of you, of course, who are a little confused on the releases of Yakuza, since we're getting so many of late, this is the remake of the original Yakuza. It's going to be releasing at a $30 price point. The physical copy will have a limited edition steelbook, and the game is very much designed to be played after Yakuza 0. So, you know, if you're interested in getting into the Yakuza series, or as it's known in Japan, Ryuga Gotoku, great entry point would be Yakuza 0 and then going into Kiwami this August.
That's awesome.
We also have word that Uncharted The Lost Legacy will be releasing in August on the 23rd in Europe, 22nd in North America, and it's going to be a $40 standalone DLC type expansion game.
Okay.
This is really exciting news for fans of Uncharted, and people who pre-order it on the PSN store will get a copy of Jack and Daxter, the precursor Legacy for PS4.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, some really exciting stuff there for fans of Naughty Dog. We also have word that Warriors All-Stars, which is going to be the North American release of Musou Stars out of Koei Tecmo, will be releasing in the Western for Western audiences on August 29th in Europe and August 29th in North America, Europe September 1st, and it'll be releasing on PS4 and PC. It's like, what do you think about that?
That's pretty cool. It's interesting to see Musou's seem to, I can't really pinpoint what caused it to become a more popular genre in the West over the past few years. I guess maybe some of like the One Piece ones and the anime licensed ones maybe kind of did it, but
well, those One Piece Musou games are actually like were the first Musou games I really got into. Even stuff like Gundam Musou, which, you know, a lot of fun and great, didn't really click for me the way One Piece Musou did. But the flip side, while I am a Gundam fanboy, I'm a much bigger One Piece fanboy.
I knew that about you. But yeah, it's good to see more Musou availability for people who are into that genre.
Excellent. All right, well, last but definitely not least here on our release dates, we have word that Dragon Quest XI will be releasing July 29th in Japan for both PlayStation 4 and Nintendo 3DS. Square Enix has stated firmly that the Switch version is still in the works. We will be hearing more about it soon, but they were not prepared to talk more about it at this time.
I wonder if that's going to be an E3 focus.
I have seen a lot of speculation on that point. All right, Saigi, do you have anything else to say?
Sulker just says, I think Musou is always popular, just in varying degrees. That's true. You know, Dynasty Warriors is always had a kind of a small but dedicated fan base, and, you know, that goes back quite a while, so.
It's true. With all that having been said, it's time for some news.
News. Oh my god, news.
All right, our first piece of news here is word that there's a new Senran Kagura game.
Oh boy.
To the Switch. It's going to be using HD Rumble for this and that. Slaggy, why don't you detail this a little bit?
So this is left boob and that is right boob, this and that.
I see what you did there.
I mean, the little preview video that they showed in the Japanese Direct showed them holding like silicone squishy models, and also flan.
Like flan?
Flan, yeah.
Oh, wow. So clearly they're trying to get just that right firmness simulated via HD Rumble.
I'm like, on one hand, this is Senran Kagura doing Senran Kagura, like it always does. On the other hand, where is my HD Rumble boner simulator?
HD Rumble boner simulator. Only you, dude. So we also have...
There's an audience out there, trust me.
You're probably right. The next cool piece of news that we have here is word that Bandai Namco has shared a really amazing and beautiful...
JG says it's called 1-2 Switch. No, that's the hand job simulator. I want one that actually simulates the feel of a boner, but...
Okay, come on. You're going to tell
me... Your enzyme says, serious, I'd buy a boner sim.
Wait, so your enzyme, would that get you to buy a Switch? And the thing I have to say is that I'm kind of with JD on this. Like, when I play 1-2 Switch and I'm doing any of the games that have intro videos with cute gay dudes, which, let's be clear, actually a lot of them, it does kind of feel like a boner sim to me.
Like... Yeah, those cowboys are definitely doing it. Anyway, prepare to dine, hashtag.
Yeah, so this new Bandai Namco... See, I'm trying so hard to say it right, and we have Sulker here in chat saying...
Namdai Banco.
Right? Like, it's gonna trip me up. Bandai Namco... Oh, your enzyme also said, yas, which I assume means, hey, Nintendo, if you want to sell another Switch, just make a boner game. Bandai Namco has shared a teaser trailer for a new title to be revealed on April 20th. The hashtag for the trailer is prepare to dine, which obviously leads many people to believe that it could be connected to something like the Food Wars anime, the Dark Souls series of games, which obviously reference prepare to die quite a bit. The really cool thing, though, is this animated trailer is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
If the game shares a style with this trailer, I think we will be in for a real visual treat. And on a personal level, something that's really cool is I actually know the people who made this animation, so to me, it's really cool to see something made by someone I know getting, you know, public adoration all over the internet.
That's super cool.
We also have word here of a new release from Ubisoft for the Nintendo Switch, starting to sound like a unprecedented partnership, as they say, because Ubisoft is bringing Monopoly to the Switch. Slaggy, I know that you are really excited about this release. You actually had specifically been reading Bitches to Filth before we began airing. Do you want to defend
Monopoly? I don't know if I go quite that far, but I mean,
it happened.
I like board games. I like Monopoly. I mean, I'd rather it be Itadaki Street, but, you know, maybe we'll see that coming, at least in Japan. But my thing, if the price point is right, you know, maybe $30 max, I think it could be fun every once in a while. And, you know, definitely with the HD Rumble for the dice, I really liked the HD Rumble from our experiences with 1-2 Switch. And it feels really cool to be able to, like, shake the dice or whatever. So, you know.
We actually have JD here agreeing. JD writes, okay, so Monopoly isn't the world's greatest game or whatever, but computerized versions of it vastly improve the playing experience.
Agreed.
I strongly agree with that statement. And, you know, I will say, you know, Monopoly, super basic as board games go. But when you're playing on a console or computer, JD follows up, half of what people don't like about the game is the setup and also having to keep track of all the rules.
That's true.
Literally exactly what I was going to say. When you're playing on a console, you don't have to worry about that extra stuff. It's actually a lot more fun. You don't have to worry about, like, who's the banker, who's going to count out all the money. if you're, like, drinking or otherwise intoxicating while playing, which obviously you should be, playing a computerized version makes it a lot easier to not have to worry about all that.
Yeah, he also says, I had a PC version when I was a kid and it was way better than the board game. I think I had that one, too.
Yeah, I can't say I had that one, but I also did have a
Monopoly game on PC.
And, I enjoyed it a heck of a lot more than playing a board game.
And my thing is that if Monopoly does well, then maybe there'll be other Hasbro games. So, I'm like, you know, they kind of do, like, the Hasbro game night thing, so...
Let's see, we also have word here of an upcoming compilation release that I'm incredibly excited for. This is a Nintendo Switch release of Namco Museum, and this is a new museum collection, and it's actually going to feature Pac-Man, Dig Dug, Galaga, Galaga 88, Tower of Druaga, Rolling Thunder, Rolling Thunder 2, Sky Kid, Splatterhouse, and Tank Force. And what's really cool about this to me, I've bought a lot of these Namco Museum releases over the years. I don't think I've ever bought one that had the arcade version of Splatterhouse in it, or Rolling Thunder 2, or Tank Force.
Yeah, I heard those three titles being singled out as, like, people were really excited about this release.
Well, yeah, because to me, this actually is Namco. You know, they are doing the re-release and ports, but at least it's stuff you can't normally find in these collections. To me, if this releases for $30 or less, it is a day one. I love Splatterhouse. Actually, when I was in Japan, saw a Splatterhouse cabinet. It was like an Astro City cabinet, but it had a Splatterhouse board in it. And, you know, it's one of those games that, especially in North America, I think a lot of people aren't really familiar with. It probably got its most notoriety for the PC Engine TurboGrafx-16 port. So to really get a little bit of exposure to the arcade release, I think is going to be really cool in 2017. I'm stoked for this release. And, you know, there's stuff like Rally X not in this collection. So it really seems to me that Namco has also left a little room for a Namco Museum 2. So let's hope this sells well and that they're inclined to continue.
Sulker says Splatterhouse looks sick AF. I never got to play it and have a mighty need. Your Enzyme says Switch needs that awesome compilation that Sega did a while back, Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection. I loved those Ultimate Genesis collections.
Yeah, that was great. You know, getting all of, like, the Phantasy Star games on there.
And hey, with Sonic Mania, you know, this would be the great time to do it.
Get the Sonic games. Well, and the Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection was, it did have a lot of the Sonic games, but it had a lot of just other Genesis games that were really fantastic. I think it had the Shining Force games. I would love to have all that stuff on the go. I completely agree with your Enzyme on this one. Let's see, we also have word here that Nintendo is prepping standalone Nintendo Switch docks and yellow Joy-Con.
Neon yellow.
Yeah, so the neon yellow Joy-Con will be releasing on June 16th, the same day as the Nintendo Switch. They will also be releasing a Joy-Con.
The Nintendo Switch?
I'm sorry, the same day that ARMS comes out for the Switch. They're also going to be releasing a Joy-Con battery life extender. And something that's interesting is that the Joy-Cons themselves actually have incredible battery life.
Yeah.
I've literally never had a Joy-Con die on me, but I had seen a lot of people note that the battery life extender is kind of huge, and so it's probably made for people whose complaint about the standalone Joy-Con is that they're kind of tiny, and that these life extenders are really probably meant to serve the dual purpose of also giving them a bigger footprint in your hand.
Yeah.
Which actually completely tracks for me, though I don't have a problem with the size of the Joy-Con.
Me either.
If I did, this is probably something I'd be really into.
It's not the size of the boat, it's the motion of the Joy-Con.
The docks will be available at licensed Nintendo Switch retailers. There will be limited quantities, however, so if you're trying to get an additional dock, I would recommend you check that out as soon as possible, starting May 19th.
Yeah, your Enzyme says, still holding out for purple Joy-Cons. Purple Joy-Cons! I've always wanted purple Joy-Cons. And JD says, yeah, I can't decide how I feel about highlight or yellow Joy-Cons. I kind of want to get the complimentary red-blue so I can have two match pairs instead. I like the red and blue not together, says your Enzyme.
I have talked about that with my co-host Shane over on Ranger Pride so many
times. Of course,
because
he wants all blue, right?
Well,
he's all about blue.
Although he actually really liked the mismatch colors of the neon set. And
I like my neon set.
It upsets me, like, looking at a neon set and just having that disparity of, like, one side is one color, the other side's the other. Like, that really bothers me.
your Enzyme says, isn't the red always the left and blue always right? They sell an opposite set so that you can buy, like, the opposite set. And they have just plain red and plain blue sets as well, so.
Yeah, so if you do want, like, a complete set, they actually did make a pretty easy way to accomplish that. You just have to buy an extra thing, which seems very Switch-era Nintendo.
And, I mean, I kind of feel that. I actually kind of want to get a blue one just to have two blue Joy-Con.
Yeah, as your enzyme notes, for $70 each, LOL, which, yeah, pretty much. I mean, they are very fancy controllers. I am a big fan of all the tech in them. I actually think that, like, playing 1-2 Switch makes it clear that, like, these are very competent controllers, you know, because it's basically a tech demo. But I do think the price is a little much, even if the tech inside them does warranted.
My thing is that if I got another set of Joy-Con, I can bring my Switch out, like, for, you know, Christmas or whatever, play Mario Kart with my family, and then there's 4 Joy-Con, you know.
In fact, JD notes, you know, $70 is for a pair, $40 is just for one individual Joy-Con.
It says, I mean, I want to get all the colors, but I also don't need to have, like, 6 Joy-Cons lying around, LOL.
That's where I'm at. Like, I want to hold out and see if they do, like, special edition Joy-Con. Like, if at some point we won't get, like, Fire Emblem Joy-Con or Smash Joy-Con, or something with, like, graphics on them. On one hand, it would be terribly distracting, and on the other hand, I live for, like, game-specific limited edition models of stuff. Like, I have a new 3DS that's, like, Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate.
Right, especially if this is a easier way to do, like, custom skins, so to speak, without having to buy a whole new 3DS.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, something that JD here notes that I actually think is really cool, since the Switch internally knows what color the Joy-Con is, I found the colored Joy-Cons really helpful for visiting friends' houses and distinguishing which are mine when syncing. That's actually a really valid and fair point.
Yeah.
All right, moving forward, we have word that Team Kirby Clash Deluxe and other Kirby 25th Anniversary projects have been announced. This is, of course, really exciting. Team Kirby Clash is an expanded standalone version of Team Kirby Clash from Planet Robobot. We actually saw it very similar to
DDD's Drum Dash. And
exactly.
Kirby Fighters.
Exactly. We also had the announcement of Kirby's Blowout Blast, which was another Robobot subgame.
Is that a Koopa
getting
Club game?
Expanded into a standalone game. What?
Is that sponsored by Koopa Club?
It should be, right? And then we actually are also getting a third game, but we don't know what it is yet. All we know is that it will be a multiplayer action game for the 3DS, currently with a holiday 2017 launch window.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Sulker, of course, states his desire for a Pokemon Joy-Con. JD agrees, OMGS, and then notes that's the one advantage to having red, blue, and yellow. Pokemon colors. Gotta catch
Pokemon.
Them all. Gotta buy them all. We also have word here that Fate X Stella, the Umbral Star, will be heading to the Nintendo Switch. This is, of course, the Musou-style beat-em-up set in the Fate universe. It's going to be launching July 21st in Europe and July 25th in North America.
Yeah, this good
is,
times.
This is something I'm really excited about because these Fate games have a huge fandom on the PlayStation family of consoles, but I don't think they've previously really been a thing on Nintendo platforms. So I hope this performs well on the Switch. I'll certainly be picking it up. It's going to be including over 30 additional outfits for the characters.
Oh, wow.
Which were originally offered as DLC for PS4 and PS Vita. And, like, they were expensive. It was, like, several dollars a costume, with the bundles for, like, 3 still being $5. So getting 30 of them with just the initial purchase is actually a hell of a savings. I mean, I don't know that you really want to make all your fighter girls wear, you know, cute maid outfits and stuff, but you'd have the option.
There's a lot of people who would.
And last but certainly not least, we have word of the upcoming Switch release coming out of Nintendo, Project Mekuru. And Saigi, I know you had noted you were excited about this one. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, so it's a Bomberman adjacent game where you have, you know, four-player versus, or at least it appeared to be four-player on what we saw, where you have to flip tiles, and you end up, if you have the most tiles flipped that match your color, then you win.
Yeah.
It sounds like a simple concept, but it just looks like it'll be a lot of fun.
JD notes, Mekuru looks really fun. I completely agree. I love these kinds of competitive games. I love local multiplayer games. I always have people over for gaming. I mean, Slackick is here right now, and Sulker's in the other room listening to this show. after this, we're probably going to go play some Smash Brothers or something. So if Project Mekiru were out now, we would then go and play that. As it stands, Project Mekiru does not yet have an official title or launch window, but, you know, the gameplay they showed on the Direct already looked pretty solid and compelling, so hopefully this is still a 2017 thing.
I hope so.
All right, well, all of this having been said, we are going to move forward here. We have one more thing to talk about before we get to the meat of our discussion today, and this is a Smash Hit article. Of course, Smash Hit articles, typically something we link all y'all in Internet Radioland out there to when we are going to talk about, you know, like a piece of games journalism that we feel requires special call out for being so well put together. And this is a really fantastic article running over on Polygon, written by James Melky, and this is The Making of Samurai Showdown. And this is actually an interview with three former team members of the Samurai Showdown team from SNK. It turns out they were known as Samurai Gumi internally. And something that's really cool, you know, is that a lot of these older SNK franchises don't really get a lot of love in 2017. But here we have like a really thorough discussion of like development choices, design choices, sort of the history of how this game was inspired to be created in the first place. It turns out that in the earliest days, the monstrous Genon was actually meant to be like the main character of the game. He's the little green guy who has like the Edward Scissorhands glove, looks very Freddy Krueger. It's something really interesting. Like, that was actually initially going to be a Final Fight style, like 2D beat 'em up, and then it became like a Hallmark fighting franchise of the 90s, which is, I think, super interesting. Anyway, I strongly recommend that you read this article. I think it's some really fantastic games journalism, and it sheds a lot of light on one of my personal favorite game franchises. Slaggy, did you read this article? What did you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for something that's maybe, I mean, I know Samurai Showdown is pretty popular, but I mean, it's not like the hugest franchise.
I'm not gonna get mad at you if you call it obscure or anything.
I was gonna say it's a little left of center, so it's cool, and Polygon usually does a really good job, like, you know, kind of digging in to find the development history of some of these sorts of series.
Yeah. All right, well, with all of that having been said, are you ready to talk about Breath of the Wild?
Oh, I've been holding my breath of the wild.
Oh, man. Can you not make jokes like that moving forward?
I can't guarantee it.
All right, so Breath of the Wild, of course, released this past March 3rd, 2017. Same release date as the Nintendo Switch console. It launched on the Nintendo Switch and the Nintendo Wii U.
Well, your enzyme says, spoil it, Daddy.
And yeah, it is to be noted, I've been working really hard on air here not to talk about any Breath of the Wild spoilers in recent episodes. Definitely have not been working. Oh, man. Chat is going to kill me. JD notes, Spike doesn't have the stamina wheel to deal with these puns.
Better go collect some Korok seeds.
Right? Wait, why would I be collecting Korok seeds?
Oh, wait, no. Oops. Go do some more shrines.
Right? Like, did you even play this game, Slaggy?
What's a Zelda?
So, I want to talk a little bit real quick, though, about how phenomenal this game is selling. You know, we did note that Breath of the Wild overall sold 1.3 million units in the U.S. in March across the Switch platform and the Wii U. Obviously, incredibly exciting, but in Japan, it's already nearing the 400,000 units sold mark as well. That is, of course, per Media Create, which is one of the most reliable disseminators of that kind of news. So, you know, for a Zelda game, that's actually a pretty big number. Zelda is typically much more popular here than it is in Japan. We also have word from Nintendo Europe that it is the best-selling Nintendo launch title ever in Europe, even outselling Wii Sports in the first weekend sales. We will be getting more numbers out of Nintendo Europe coming probably toward the end of April, but at least at the moment, Slaggy, what do you think about these phenomenal sales for Breath of the Wild?
I'm super happy for it. I'm not surprised. I mean, it's a spectacular game, which apparently I didn't play because Sulker says I was playing Nintendogs instead.
To be fair, I kind of side with Sulker on this. I think it's more likely than not that you were raising a miniature schnauzer.
Yeah.
So, you got me. Slaggy, do you want to talk a little bit about who made Breath of the Wild?
Nintendo.
Oh, bitch.
So, This game came out of Nintendo Entertainment Planning and Development, which is, you know, kind of the new merger. I say new, but it was from September of 2015, of the Entertainment Analysis and Development Department and Software Planning Development Divisions, which, you
typically
know,
we refer to them as EAD and SPD.
Yes, yes.
Like Power Rangers.
I know, I was just going to say, it sounds like Power Rangers. So, coming out of Nintendo EPD, directed by Hidemaru Fujibayashi-san, and that is a name who has been associated with Zelda for about a decade or so now, since, or actually more about 15 years or so. Originally was with Capcom, doing some things, including Magical Tetris Challenge, which was a Mickey Mouse-themed Tetris game. Before working in video games, apparently was a designer of haunted attractions for Japanese theme parks, so that's kind of cool.
That explains so much.
Yeah, but was the director, planner, and scenario writer on the Oracle of Seasons and Oracle of Ages games.
Oh, also, back when they worked with Capcom / Flagship on those games.
Right, and Four Swords, which also had Capcom involvement.
Excellent.
And then Minish Cap, Phantom Hourglass, Skyward Sword, and Breath of the Wild.
And he was also the director on Skyward Sword.
Correct.
Now, something that's interesting, Slaggy, do you recall Skyward Sword terribly well?
I recall getting stuck on a part where I had to shield bash, and it kept breaking my shield, and I've literally never made it past that point.
Oh, buddy. Something interesting to me about Skyward Sword and Breath of the Wild is that I actually kind of feel like Breath of the Wild took a lot of cues from Skyward Sword, but really took them to sort of their logical conclusion.
Right, because you could have different stats and stuff in that game, right?
And, well, yeah.
And having to get new shields and stuff.
And though I would argue that in some ways Skyward Sword represents the nadir of Zelda design with regard to, like, how hand-holdy it was, how sort of, you know, the story focus really slowed down the gameplay quite a bit. We also did see it introduce stuff like some of the climbing aspects, the stamina wheel, giving Link, you know, the running ability, and just generally having a little bit more of a focus on environmental interactions over the extremely linear and canned and dungeon interactions that we had seen previously.
Right. I mean, I really feel like this Zelda is kind of the sum of all the Zeldas to this point, and they kind of even kind of presented it that way, honestly.
We also have JD here saying Skyward Sword introduced monotheism, how everything is about Hylia now and not the triple goddesses. That is absolutely true, actually.
Yeah, I love the three goddesses.
Yes, three goddesses slay. Your enzyme notes, Skyward Sword introduced boredom. Again,
aww.
I don't disagree with that statement. I'm simply noting that to me, Skyward Sword was sort of like, to me, the seed of what would become Breath of the Wild. Obviously, I think Breath of the Wild is a better game on literally every every level. That having been said, Sly, why don't you continue talking about the production staff a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So, of course, it was produced by Eiji Aonuma-san, who, you know, really got his name was kind of, you know, first thrust into the spotlight with Ocarina of Time, and then Majora's Mask, and really took over the helm of being the Zelda guy from Miyamoto-san. So, and you know, we talked on our Zelda episode about how under Aonuma's supervision that Zelda was kind of getting stale and kind of, you know, really needed a breath of fresh air. And I'm happy to say that Breath of the Wild succeeded on every level. I totally have full faith in Aonuma-san now, and I feel kind of bad for, you know, kind of giving him a little bit of negativity about the series getting stale, because clearly his vision here was spot on, just, I mean, absolutely perfect.
Absolutely.
The writer was Akihito Toda, a name I'm not super familiar with. And the composers were Manaka Kataoka and Yasuaki Iwata. Again, names that I'm not super familiar with.
Well, so the games that Manaka-san, Kataoka-san is largely connected to, stuff like Wii Fit, Animal Crossing City Folk, Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks, Animal Crossing New Leaf, Super Smash Bros. For Wii U, and now finally Breath of the Wild.
Okay.
So she's actually well known within some of these newer EAD productions, which I'm actually a big fan of her style. It tends to be a little bit more sparse and environmental almost.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true.
But I actually feel like
here.
It adds a lot to the atmosphere of these games.
For sure.
And that is actually something that I saw a lot of criticisms about the music in Breath of the Wild. And so maybe that would be a place to talk a little bit about this. A lot of people noting, you know, the game doesn't have as many, like, strong themes.
But now, it has little motifs.
Now, in my conversations with you, you know, we've discussed a little bit how the way music is used sparingly in Breath of the Wild sort of evokes similar feelings to how music is typically used in Japanese cinema.
Right.
Is that a statement you would still stand behind?
Oh, definitely.
And would you like to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, in anime and Japanese cinema, like, a lot of times, like, silence is really important. In Western productions, we have to have, like, little music or noise or something, like, in everything. Like, Western audiences, for whatever reason, seem to be uncomfortable with silences. But, and it's interesting because Bisselby says, yes, the music's forgettable. And, I think what is such a stark contrast from prior games is that, you know, music was so central to these games to the point where Ocarina of Time, Wind Waker were about, like, making music, you know? Bisselby also continues, the music is more of an expression of the game's environment and less about storytelling. And that's definitely true. You'll just hear, like, these little motifs, but, I did appreciate that, you know, when you did hear music, it was, you know, definitely cueing you into, like, what was around. You would hear, like, the little,
How about that little tinkling of piano, discordant jazz piano keys when a guardian is nearby?
Right, right. I mean, immediately, once you've experienced that the first time, every time you hear that, like, piano rumbling, you're like, oh, shit, gotta run away. Or even things like Eponosom being evoked through the stables, you know. I think it's really cute how, you know, there's just these little motifs of recognizable music. You can get that up through in Hyrule Castle as well. I was just like, oh, wow, you know, just some of the... I feel like Hyrule Castle almost had more music going on in it. And it, like, really made it more dramatic.
Yeah, I would strongly agree with your take there. Hyrule Castle, to me, was really where the music kicked up. But it actually really does also fit in with what Bisselby is saying here with regard to the music really being an expression of the game's environment. To me, I actually think that I prefer that rather than being about storytelling. But for me, the thing that's really notable about Zelda is that I felt like the focus of Breath of the Wild, and I'm talking specifically about Breath of the Wild here when I say about Zelda, is that in Breath of the Wild, I really felt like I was having a series of emergent experiences unique to my playthrough, as opposed to following a set storyline per se, similar to how previous Zeldas have gone. You know, it was... wasn't like, oh, I found Epona because I learned Epona's song, and then Epona's song played, and now I'm on Epona's back and Epona's song is playing. It was more like, oh, wow, I just found a horse out in the wild, and I tamed him. You know, some music notes played while this was happening, but it was less of, like, a cinematic experience and more like this really cool event that happened organically in my game. And to me, the music was in service of that. And to me, it made it feel, I guess, a little more impactful and meaningful to me as an individual player. I want to note, did we ever call on JD's comment here about Skyward Sword's super campy antagonist that flirts with Link?
We
because
did not.
That is the realness.
Yeah.
And that, like, tongue thing, which, if you haven't played Skyward Sword far enough to know about that character, you should go back to it, because especially Psychic, I think, would get a lot out of that character.
Campy queens? Yes.
Yes. Your Enzyme, of course, notes that motifs are what Zelda's known for. JD commented, I loved seeing this bit on Twitter, and links to Twitter user Rock Lee Smile. I love how Zelda teaches players that hearing dissonant jazz means you only have a few moments to live, which is the absolute realness.
Bisselby says, that being said, and continuing from earlier, when I do hear a a nostalgic motif, my heart flutters.
I actually will agree with Bissell B, and I know I called out, like, Epona's song as, you know, a little bit representative of an archaic game style. I will say, the themes in Breath of the Wild that evoke Epona's theme, every time my heart got weepy. Like, every time. Mm-hmm. So then there is definitely something to be said for that kind of cinematic music, clearly. I really like the change of pace. I really like this new direction. And I thought the music worked in service to that.
Mm-hmm. I think this trade-off is that there's not really any new music. I mean, aside from probably the Guardians with their, their jazzy piano. I mean, you think of, like, Wind Waker, our Game Boy theme. You know, Wind Waker has amazing music. I would say that arguably I get more nostalgic for Wind Waker's music than I do for even Ocarina of Time, like the great sea and stuff. So I think that's the one trade-off, is we don't have any, like, sweeping grand orchestral themes in that way that, like, stand out and, like, immediately make you think, oh, Breath of the Wild.
I mean, you say that, but at the same time, that little jazz theme will stick out in my head forever as emblematic of Breath of the Wild.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's, I would say it's, up there with, like,
wow, you just did that. JD notes, the shrine music is my favorite in this game, and I've been trying to figure out what instrument the main melodic voice is. It almost sounds like bagpipes. I do not have an answer for you, but I do agree that shrine music is fantastic. That having been said, I want to move forward here and talk a little bit more about the dev history of the game. Obviously, we've already noted, initially designed as a Wii U game. Initially, apparently, the Wii U, and specifically the Wii U gamepad, actually had a bearing on the game's story.
Well, that was going to be the Sheikah Slate, probably.
Well, and that is the assumption, of course, that we've all come to, but we actually don't really know the degree to which they had to change the story when it was no longer a Wii U exclusive title, but they have actively discussed that, which I think is very interesting. Of course, as Slykick had noted, Al Numa-san reiterated on numerous occasions that the focus with Breath of the Wild was really to rethink the conventions of Zelda, and there was also further impacted by the objective-based gameplay from A Link Between Worlds.
Right.
Which, you know, they found to be very reminiscent of the original Zelda, the way it was non-linear and kind of more open world. And so Aonuma-san, seeing how response to that game went, said that he wanted to alter the norms of Zelda by reforming dungeons and puzzle solving. He also wanted to create a game where the story was entirely optional and where it would be possible for players to reach the end of the game without progressing the story at all.
And someone who typically doesn't like story in games, I assume that you really like that option.
Irony of irony.
You love the story of this game.
I love the story in Breath of the Wild. I have seen a lot of criticism of the story, particularly from feminist voices in the online game space. I struggle with that a little bit, and I don't mean that to speak over feminists, obviously. I certainly consider myself a male feminist ally. That having been said, I've seen people argue that Zelda is, you know, a damsel in distress.
I don't think she is in this game.
Is reduced in this game to just being like an item or a MacGuffin. But to me, I actually think that Zelda in Breath of the Wild is fundamentally written as a strong character who, through her own actions and smart thinking, single-handedly saves the world. It's really difficult for me because even in the game's story, she's not captured by Ganon. Ganon is captured by her.
Yeah.
Like, on a fundamental level, I feel like this is a Zelda that is in control of herself and creates the scenario by which Ganon is defeated. It is, of course, one of the hallmarks of her story, even, is literally her oppression by the patriarchy. She is interested in mechanics and future tech in the form of, you know, the Sheikah technology that is all around the world in this setting. And, you know, she's learning what makes it tick. She's learning how to repair things.
She's taking pictures on her Sheikah slate.
Right? But, and you know, very much her father wants her to conform to the traditional role of a female of the royal Hylian family.
Yeah, when I unlocked that memory, I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, right? But to me, it really does create a more three-dimensional character. I've even seen a lot of people note in terms of her character design, you know, she wears pants. This is not a Zelda who's constantly in a dress, constantly wearing all of this royal gear to look super pretty that isn't at all all realistic for her to be fighting in. Like, she's in armor. She's in, like, pants that she can ride a horse in.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, I think that this take on Zelda, super, super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, she's probably my second favorite version of the Zelda character.
She's probably my number one favorite.
I have to say second because Tetra is always going to be my favorite. Little pirate girl.
Understandable. But anyway, my point through all this, I really dug the story, as you could probably tell by my rant just now, and the reduced focus actually made me want more. Typically when I'm playing Zelda games and, you know, the narrative is forced on me, and before every dungeon I have to hear, oh, this sage is in this dungeon trapped in a crystal, he needs your help, and then at the end of every dungeon, oh, now you will have a conversation with all seven sages, we're gonna talk for 20 minutes. That kind of stuff really wears on me. But the way the story was portioned out in this game, where every few hours you're seeing, you know, 90 seconds of story and then you're right back to your adventure, it really, for me, enhanced the impact that these bits of story were having, because I never felt like, oh, I would rather be playing. It was always a welcome respite. What was your take on the storytelling pacing, Slidekick?
I mean, the thing is that the storytelling is basically at your own pace. If you wanted to go and experience a lot of story content, then, you know, you could go and do all the story content, or you could spend hours in between each divine beast exploring the world and, you know, not even really seeing any NPCs, just out being in the wild, taking breaths.
I see what you did there.
Bizzle B, touching on Zelda, says, I agreed, I love Zelda in this game, and Tetra, yes.
Well, so with that having been noted, you know, the reduced focus on story, actually for us, I think it's safe to say, made it a more compelling story.
And for me, it made the characters, the moments where the characters were in the spotlight really shine to me, instead of just being bogged down with, like, a lot of, like, character plot, blah, 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 blah. When the characters did have their moments, like, it was really impactful for me.
Well, and it made me, yeah, really like all of the characters. Whereas normally Zelda NPCs are a little irritating to me, the sages or whatever, it's like, oh my god, stop talking. In this game, you know, you end up getting the backstory of the four guardians that helped seal Ganon in Hyrule Castle at the costs of their lives in the previous assault on Ganon before Link Calamity Ganon. Before Link is put into the Shrine of Resurrection from getting beat down. I ended up liking all of the Guardians very much. There was none of that, what was the name of the Zora princess in Ocarina of Time?
Rito?
I hated that Zora princess.
She's like, we're gonna get married. Oh, I'm in Jabba Jabba now.
Yeah, I ended up super into, like, all of the Guardians here. Several of them, I'm like, ooh, girl, I want to hear a little more of your story, which is meant to sound a little flirty. JD points out that was Rudo. Princess Rudo.
Rito. Like, Rito is the bird
princess
tribe.
Rudo. What?
I was saying Rito because that's the bird tribe.
Indeed. And JD notes Bolson Appreciation Club.
Yes.
Which I say yes. So moving forward, in creating the final game, which actually uses a modified version of the Havok physics engine, the developers actually had designed a fully playable two-dimensional prototype game.
I want to play that so bad.
Wild. We got a live, but we got a demonstration of that at the 2017 Game Developers Conference, GDC. They actually talked there on their presentation, Change and Constant, Breaking Conventions with The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. We got a little bit insight to how they view the game's systems interrelating to each other as, like, a physics system and chemistry system. And that specifically is how they look at the ways every item in the game world interacts with one another. Now, to me, I actually think that's a really interesting take. I have noted one of my biggest problems with Zelda, and 3D Zelda in particular, in the past, has been everything is incredibly linear. All of the interactions and animations are completely canned.
There's basically one way to solve a puzzle.
Exactly. There's basically nothing you can do that the game isn't like, this is how you do this, period. Whereas Breath of the Wild, through this concept of, like, physics meet chemistry with regard to, like, behavioral interactions, it sort of comes out like an improv class, where rather than it's like being, you must do this, all of the things you do in game are a little bit more like, yes, and, you know, very similar in concept. And I like the idea that it ultimately turns into a situation where rather than you must do X, Y, and Z, it's basically like, all right, you're going to start at A, get to Z, I don't care how
you
do it.
Have you seen the way that people have cheesed some of the shrines by, like, putting, like, doing a bomb and then doing, like, stasis, I think, and then shield surfing and then basically flying and then going over to, like, where the shrine's exit is?
Yeah, you know, I have, and I think that that kind of stuff is remarkable. And I know there are people out there who are like, oh, that's cheating, it's so dumb, the game shouldn't let you break it that way. But to me, it's like, dude, this is way more interesting. Like, I can do whatever I want, and, like, the game is gonna let me, and the game is gonna, like, totally allow for it.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is so much more exciting than like find the lantern in this dungeon.
Okay, JD's saying Thunderblades are really useful.
Now every puzzle will be solved with this lantern.
Yeah, JD says Thunderblades are really useful for cheesing the electric puzzle shrines.
Oh yeah, and all metal weapons are.
Yeah,
I actually tried not to do that, but more recently while I've been playing, because I'm actually trying to get all 120 shrines. I'm past the 100 mark. I actually have been doing that more recently for some of the later ones, just because now that I've seen how experimental and playful you can get, it's almost more fun to me to like, okay, I see what the real solution is, I acknowledge it, but how else could I make this work? And mm-hmm. it's crazy, like, the degree to which you can really make anything work. I find that freedom of gameplay very
compelling.
Bisselbee
says it's a choose-your-own-adventure Zelda game. It's a unique experience.
And I think that's absolutely true, both with regard to the actual story stuff, and even just, like, the gameplay. The gameplay is very much like, choose how you want to do this, and I find that it turns out remarkably compelling. We also had JD here note, he once did it by accident. I assume this is with regard to the electric puzzles, striking a switch to see if I could turn it on, and was like, whoa, this is neat.
And for me, it's like so refreshing to be able to figure out and come up with a plan to get through a shrine or through part of the Divine Beast, instead of like, oh, I have to shoot this eye with this arrow and then hop on the moving platform, and oh, I ran out of time, so I've got to do it again. Like, I found very little things that required that level of, like, precision. I mean, maybe stasis, some stasis puzzles definitely required some careful timing, but, like, I thought it was a lot more, I found it a lot more rewarding to solve the puzzles.
Yeah, you know, and again, exactly what I was saying, I just find this game very rewarding. I find its approach to puzzle solving extremely rewarding. That having been said, we need to keep this train moving forward on these spirit tracks, as it were.
Ah!
I thought you'd like that. This game obviously marks the first time that voice acting was used in a main Zelda title. Link does remain a silent protagonist, but Aonuma-san had actually noted that the first time he had heard a character use a human voice in Breath of the Wild, it ended up having a tremendous effect on him with regard to really making the story connect with him more, which he wanted to have that effect on players.
Mm-hmm.
So that is actually the point where the team decided to do voiceover for all of the cutscenes. Initially, they were only going to do voice acting for, like, the key scenes. And, you know, Nintendo ended up doing voiceovers and subtitles in 9 different languages. That's how much of a focus this was. So it's really interesting to me, you know, we think of Breath of the Wild as like, oh, the story has been, like, played down, it's de-emphasized, but I really think that they focused really hard on making the minimized story, like, sort of have maximum effectiveness.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that's something that allowed me to connect to the characters instead of just being like, ah, oh, ah, like they had their personality. So, like, one that I think of in particular is Rivali, the Rito champion.
Rivali's Gale.
And, like, just his sassiness and kind of like, oh, and then, you know, on the, just like all the guardians I thought were really well acted, and the kind of the guardians' descendants, like, you know, our boy Prince Thedon, but and like Urbosa I thought was like really well voice acted, and Zelda too. I mean, Zelda had parts where she was like very snooty, and that came across, and just the way that it enhanced the characterization, I think, really allowed me to connect with the characters.
I would strongly agree there. Let's see. I want to talk about some of the chat log real quick. We have Your Enzyme. I wish I could have already played Breath of the Wild so I could chime in. Yeah, I would highly recommend it, Your Enzyme. I'm not even typically a big Zelda fan, and this is probably one of my favorite games I've played in years. JD notes, is your Phantom Hourglass running out? Which is a good way to say it. We have about 32 minutes left with our normal schedule. We'll probably go over that a little bit. The main reason for our two-hour time limit on episodes now is that that's what our slot on the Voice of Geeks Network over at VogNetwork.com.
VogNetwork.com.
Is slotted for. That having been said, through editing out silences, deleting the occasional bonehead comment I make, we typically save a little bit of time on the edited version that goes to VOG. So, yeah, we will probably go an extra 5 or 10 minutes here. Sorry, y'all, for screwing with your schedule like that. We also have word here from Bizzleby. I think the memories are so much more impactful when I hear Zelda's voice. I strongly agree there, especially the ones where she's, like, crying and stuff. It really sold the drama for me. JD notes, the Zoras note that there's a formal/plain distinction that marks an age difference. It made me sad that English doesn't have that kind of distinction. Completely agree. You will hear no argument from me there. He notes, I think that's why some characters have a British accent, to make them sound old. I think that's probably an accurate statement. Your Enzyme notes, I've heard the memories are the worst part of the game because of the terrible voiceovers. I'd fundamentally disagree there. I do think that one or two of the voices are maybe on the lower end of what you would think or what you would expect out of like a English dub anime, but for the most part, in the English version of the game, I think the voice acting is more well done than most anime dubs, and the Japanese voice acting is, of course, superb. So, obviously, Japanese voice acting is taken way more serious as a profession than here. Sulker notes, really, I loved the voice acting. And yeah, I did too, as I noted, with one or two exceptions. I actually thought that this game was extremely well dubbed, and I thought it was Nintendo's best effort yet at English voice acting.
Yeah, definitely sets a good precedent for future titles.
And Your Enzyme notes, an extra 5 or 10 minutes of you two is A-okay for me. Aw, thanks, buddy. I'm going to enjoy that extra time with you, too. So I want to go now into a little bit more of our thoughts and focus a little bit more on our opinions on things. And I want to start here, Slaggy. I want to ask you, what is your take on the art style and design philosophy of Breath of the Wild?
I think it's
compared a lot to Skyward Sword and Wind Waker.
It's kind of a meld of the two, really, and I think it's beautiful. It's like, you know, it's meant to look like a painting, and specifically the painting where, like, they paint on the water, right? I always forget the technique that's called, but it's beautiful, and I think that I always prefer something with a little more style than, you know, trying to be hyper-realistic. I will take something like Breath of the Wild any day, or, you know, the Persona games, especially Persona 5 being, like, you know, looks like an anime, basically, that you're playing. So I think that, especially with so much of the focus being on the environment, you know, the very soft kind of filters and stuff, it works really well. And I see a lot of people also comparing it, even prior to the release, to, like, a Studio Ghibli film.
Yeah, and, you know, especially in the cutscenes, the voice acting and everything, it felt very Ghibli to me, which is 100% of the time a good thing.
Yeah.
I feel that this game is beautiful. This week I actually bought 3 new PS4 games, and this is relevant, but it'll take me a second to get there. They were Nier, Yakuza 0, and Horizon Zero Dawn. And so now that I've finally played a little bit of Horizon, and I say a little bit, I mean literally like 30 minutes, I really have to say, I think that the art style of Breath of the Wild is a little more to my taste, but Horizon is a beautiful game. And I bring this up in this context because, you know, Psychic, you were saying that you would prefer this kind of art style to a more realistic art style, which is how I would describe Horizon. But, and again, I don't want it to seem like I'm bashing Horizon because I'm actually already finding it to be very compelling. It's probably going to be the next game I really focus on, even over Persona 5 a little bit. And I'll talk about that during our What's Up segment later this episode. But very impressed by Horizon. Horizon, but I do have to say my tastes also lean a little more toward the direction of Breath of the Wild in terms of art design. That having been said, I am floored by how pretty Horizon is. Like, dude, that is a remarkably good
game. And I think part of what I like about the art style, I mean, I loved Wind Waker back in the day. You know, and a lot of course, we've talked about, I mean, everyone knows how widely hated that was at first. And, you know, I think that Skyward Sword and Wind Waker look nicer to me than Twilight Princess, where it was tried to be, like, as realistic
Although,
as they could.
I will say, Twilight Princess in HD with, you know, some of the reworked texture, so some of the funky stuff looks a little better, but admittedly also a little more stylized, I actually thought came together really well.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like, even in Twilight Princess, there was the Twilight areas that looked really cool. But, yeah. I mean, I will take a game like, you know, Okami, where, you know, it's like a moving work of art.
Stylization. The game.
Yeah.
Of course, I want to go to the chat real quick. Your Enzyme. I can't remember where I heard that, but it was... Oh, it got a new message and it screwed up my window. I can't remember where I heard that, but it was one of the complaints I've heard. That's, of course, with regard to the voice acting comment. I mean, I've had a lot of experience with dubbed Japanese media. I don't prefer things dubbed, but it's an inevitability. Sometimes you're going to see that stuff. I think Zelda is on the stronger end of that paradigm, personally.
Mm-hmm.
Bizzle B notes, yes, Studio Ghibli. That was my first thought. Strongly agreed. We're simpatico on that one. Your Enzyme, yay. Horizon is wonderful. So far, I completely agree. JD notes, Twilight Princess, we hit me solidly in the uncanny valley. I'll have to try the remake to see if it's any better. I believe it is. However, like, some of, like, the weird-looking babies and stuff look way weirder in HD.
Yeah,
so
I've seen pictures of it, yeah.
It's still gonna hit the uncanny valley, unfortunately. Ugh. And Your Horizon notes, so much great world-building in Horizon. They really put in a lot of focus on each area's lore and whatnot. And that, to me, is actually why I ended up going into Horizon. I've heard a lot of people say that it's... paced story-wise very similar to Breath of the Wild, where there is a main story and you can focus on it, or you can just go off and do the exploration and building your stats and getting better gear together and stuff. And that kind of pacing really appeals to me right now, especially after Breath of the Wild, so I'm really looking forward to that. And so far, at least what I've seen of Horizon, I'm very interested in that world. So moving forward, I want to talk about what I think is the defining strength of Breath of the Wild, and that is the gameplay.
Mm.
So, the game design of Breath of the Wild has been described, rather than an open world game, it has been described as an open air game.
With, yes, gliding!
Right? And, you know, the gliding specifically, I don't think was the point of open air. I think,
but it's so fun.
They had meant it more to describe the general concept of everything being available, the structure of the game being very user-defined. That having been said, to me, one of the biggest pioneering moments or achievements of Breath of the Wild is that through the combination of how the stamina gauge works and how climbing works and how the air glider works, I did truly feel like that design goal that we hear so often, where if you can see something, you can go to it, you can explore every inch of the game world, it's all playable. This is the first time I have ever felt that that promise was realized.
Not
it's
only
like,
that,
I'd like
but...
to hear from you. And what are your thoughts on that?
Not only that, but also the fact that the world compelled you to want to explore it. Like, you see something off in the distance, and you're like, ooh, I want to go there and see what's up. Even though, you know, there are a lot of areas that were just shrines and stable and tower. You know, they're, not every area had a divine beast, so, you know, you're really going there, and there might be some, like, special foods you can get. Like, down in the Pharaon Tower area, I believe it is, there's the Dorian fruits, which are, like, one of the best ways to get bonus hearts. And so before I went to fight Calamity Ganon, I just went to Pharaon Tower and glided over and got some Dorian fruits to cook. But yeah, I mean, for me, that's one of the game's hugest successes. And I think it initially evoked in me what I loved about Assassin's Creed, particularly the Assassin's Creed 2 trilogy, which was just, you know, climbing and hopping around and stuff. But, I mean, taken to definitely the next level. So I just found it really rewarding in that way.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, again, really leading to the idea of players pacing their own progress and exploration through the world, you know, you can expand your stamina gauge, which dictates how long you can climb and how far you can glide.
Right.
You can extend that gauge for every set of four shrines you do. You get to choose whether you want a new segment of stamina bar or if you want a new heart container. I felt like that was a really interesting choice because I always felt like the game was asking me to evaluate, like, do I need utility in terms of increasing my exploration potential, or do I need, you know, more life to stay alive with survivability? And so I always felt like the game was giving me a little bit of tension from that choice, but I mean tension constructively, as, you know, sort of the meat of the game, what's keeping me hooked, what's keeping me exploring and compelled to do these shrines. And to me, it created a really great feedback loop of, like, I want to adventure so that I can cash in my shrines or my orbs from the shrines to get more stamina so that I can continue adventuring.
Right. I found that after a couple of stamina upgrades, I was able to get pretty much everywhere I needed. And then I focused a lot more on hearts just to get more survivability and get those various Ganon bosses down. Over in chat, we said flying around in that game was one of my favorite parts of the game, says Sulker. Using Revali's Gale to just skip so much of the landscape by air was hella fun.
And that's another thing I want to note, is for me, and I have seen some people complain about the climbing in-game, I felt that the climbing was really compelling. You know, obviously, you like timing, like how often you're going to use jumps while climbing,
right?
Since they take you much further, but also take more of your stamina bar away. It, to me, the moment-to-moment gameplay was fun.
Mm-hmm.
I, for whatever reason, like just gliding from a cliff to another cliff and seeing all of the landscape below me zoom by, anytime I'm like using the stasis ability to like knock a log that I'm standing on forward and then jump off it so that I can fly forward much faster on the glider, I found that moment-to-moment gameplay stuff super fun. And that is another thing. I feel like most games don't have enjoyable traversal, but in this game, just the act of exploration, in addition to being rewarding, was also fun in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Which, funny enough, Biz will be here, remarks.
Oh, I need to do this one, please.
Sure, go for
Channeling
it.
Bell, I want adventure in the great wide somewhere.
So,
you wouldn't have seen it.
The actual, like, gameplay, to me, so compelling, and it really just creates this sense of there's this like huge world that I was eager to get out there and see. You know, getting my map filled out, as opposed to something in like Assassin's Creed, where getting the map filled out is purely for the sake of utility, I was actively enjoying finding towers and getting the map filled out. It was fun and exciting. JD also notes, there's apparently a unique recipe posted on the wall in each stable. I've been meaning to try each of them. Sulker, ooh, I didn't know that, JD. I think I'm going to do that now. Bizzleby, I agreed with the Assassin's Creed comparison, presumably the one Psychic made a little bit ago, especially with lookout points and unlocking the map.
Mm,
it gave
yeah.
me a great sense, such a great sense of accomplishment. I do also agree there. In the interest of moving forward, I also want to talk about how the game sort of changes the traditional Zelda recipe of finding items, using items, typically within the same area.
And then never really using it again.
Right?
Unless it's a hookshot.
In the first starting area, before you're given your glider, you're given four glyphs. You do have to do a shrine for each of these glyphs, but, you know, you get Magnesis, you get Bomb, you get Stasis, and you get Cryosis. Magnesis lets you interact with metallic items, either pushing them, pulling them, moving them from afar. Bomb, of course, is the traditional Zelda bomb. Stasis freezes things in time, and something interesting about stasis is when you put something in stasis, all of your hits rack up on it and are then applied at the same time once stasis ends. This has practical implications for combat because you can damage enemies rapidly this way, but also in terms of interacting with the environment, you can, for my example, with my example of a log earlier, stand on a log after you've beaten the crap out of it in one direction, and then once all the hits are applied, it zooms off, flying away from all that accrued damage. Really, really amazing ability, super fun to play with, and that's the thing, Magnesis and Stasis in particular, super fun to play with. And wrapping that up, we also have cryosis, which causes ice blocks to raise out of any body of water. And quite excitedly, that includes bodies of water that maybe are coming down walls like waterfalls.
Yeah.
It turns out to be a lot of fun to play with. I felt like this take was really interesting, giving you all of these dungeoning tools in the beginning of the game, and then saying, you know, have fun with these throughout the game world. To me, it gave me a level of freedom I liked, and it never spoiled a puzzle for me, because in traditional Zelda, like, okay, this is the lantern puzzle. Oh, this is a lantern dungeon. Oh, puzzle. I bet it uses the lantern. In Breath of the Wild, I always felt when there was a puzzle, like, I don't know how to solve this, but I know I have the right tool for it. I just need to figure it out. That to me created a much more interesting dynamic with how I related to the puzzles and how I interacted with them. What was your take on the glyphs and how they're utilized?
I liked having this smaller tool set that had a variety of interesting applications and uses, both in the outer world and, the overworld and the underworld, to use classic Zelda terms, rather than something like, some of the games where, you know, Wizrobe's wand, which even in the original Zelda, how often did you actually end up using that? You know, I know that's technically kind of a weapon, but... I really appreciated that, especially with the bombs. Abyssal Beast says unlimited bombs is a big yes, and stasis is amazing.
Completely agreed.
And I loved finding, I found it really rewarding to figure out, oh, for example, when I was over here a couple weeks ago, I was like, I'm stuck on this shrine, and then you had used stasis on an ice block, lifted up a metal crate with magnesis, and then... the ice block slid under the thing so that it wouldn't get melted by flames. And even though I had to have your help solve that, I was just like, wow. It just made it really fun and compelling.
Excellent.
And I think the other thing is that when you would get to puzzles in traditional Zelda dungeons, you would find that you had to do it, like I said, that way. And what I really liked about the shrines is that they were like a little bite-sized puzzle, and then you're done with it. Instead of just being like, oh, I've got to solve this puzzle before I continue on with the dungeon. Whereas like the Divine Beasts, on the other hand, were more about using the kind of macro picture of like, how am I changing the actual dungeon around to... traverse it in different ways, which I thought was really compelling and took a lot of the focus away from here's a random room of Keese or Lizalfos that you have to clear to get a blue rupee, you know? It was more about purely focusing on getting through and puzzle solving in that way.
Absolutely. And, something that I want to just build on that you had noted is that due to the freedom of design that the shrines afforded, you know, I actually feel like they were able to make some of them, like, blistering hard because they're optional.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you run into a roadblock, you can just go around it and your game progress isn't impeded. I feel like, you know, as a player, it gave me the freedom to do these things at my own choosing. And from the development standpoint, it gave them the ability to and the freedom to design as difficult and interesting designs as they'd like, which is another thing I often think about Zelda, particularly the non-Link Between Worlds Zelda games. I always feel like things are sort of designed for the lowest common denominator because they want people to be able to get through the games. Breath of the Wild, though, I feel like is the first Zelda game in a long time where, like, there are many things that are, like, legit hard and challenging. And we haven't even discussed here, but, like, the average person playing Breath of the Wild dies so many times. And even if you're reasonably good at games, you're still gonna die, you know, a lot.
Maybe not Dark Souls a lot.
Dark Souls a lot, but still a lot. Slaggy, I want to ask you, did you often feel like the game was challenging you more than other Zeldas, and to what degree?
Definitely. At least up until the end, there was definitely a period at the end where I hadn't died in quite a while up until I got into Hyrule Castle, so I felt as I built up, you know, and that's because I chose to get more hearts and shrines and stuff, and got smarter about combat. I think being able to interact with the environment so much, like, for example, I didn't kill the Lynels in Hyrule Castle. I just climbed the fuck out of there. I was like, nope. Or situations where, like, earlier on when I didn't have powerful weapons yet, I killed some Lizalfos or Moblins or something by standing above them and throwing bombs down and just chipped away at their health. And so... while I do feel that there was definitely a challenge there, I felt that there were ways to work around it. And then I even found, like, Once I had built up, some more powerful weapons in my roster and had more hearts and had some good food cooked, like going back and trying some of the different Ganon fights in the Divine Beasts that I had put off, I was like, oh, wow, this is a lot more manageable.
Excellent. Well, then I want to talk now about sort of the last big gameplay note here, and then we're going to start wrapping this conversation up so we can wrap the show up because it is getting late already. But I do want to ask you, you had noted weapons and collecting weapons, and that does bring us to the highly contentious topic of debate regarding weapon durability. I've seen a lot of takes on the function that weapon durability serves in the game. I think one of the big ones for me in particular is that it really does force the player to use a wide variety of weapons. I have noted this in discussions on this game that, I typically, when playing games, will get a weapon that works well for me and then just use that weapon for the rest of the game, even if it's not like the highest damage potential weapon. For example, in like 2D Castlevania games, the Igavania, Metroidvania style ones, typically once I've gotten like a great sword, that's it. I'm using a great sword for the rest of my game. I don't care if a character is strong against it. I don't care if it's slow. That's what I'm using. That's what I like. Whereas Zelda really forced me through the weapon durability system. I had to use every kind of weapon because sometimes the only weapon at my disposal was like, oh, this skeleton I just beat dropped his arm. I guess I'm going to start beating things with his arm until I can find a real sword. For some people, that's very irritating and very upsetting. But for me, it created a situation where I had to try everything. I had to have different experiences. I've also seen people just talk about it from a pure resource management angle, likening it very similar to how ammo might work in a first-person shooter game. Slaggy, in what way did the weapon durability work or not work for you?
I think it wasn't a problem for me, with one exception, because they were so plentiful. Interestingly, I would find that, for example, if I was in a Divine Beast or whatever, I would use a little bit weaker weapon to kill some of like the little baby guardians so that I could save my more powerful weapons for, the boss fights and stuff. And so that was really interesting way to think about that. But the only time it really impacted me was in the Thunderbolt Ganon fight, where it really is beneficial to have a one-hand weapon and a shield so you can block parry. Thunderbolt when parry and when he's doing that zoom-zoom thing. And
Zoom.
I had started the fight at a point where my one-handed weapons were kind of low in durability, and the answer could have been just going out and getting some better weapons, but instead I just ended up finally making it through.
Let's see. Catching up on our chat log, we have JD. Oh man, yes, standing on a cliff and throwing bombs at enemies is so fun. They get that little ... and look at the bomb, then boom.
Yes.
Yes. I love that. And after you've done that to a group, a lot of times, once you've done it once, the next time you try, they'll like get smart and like stand a little ways away and shoot an arrow at it, or like they'll kick it away so that it doesn't explode in their face. Little touches like that really sold the game world to me. Bizzleby notes, since this game is choice-oriented, the degree of difficulty entirely depends on your current ability level.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are obviously challenging at first. There are ways to get around it, which I completely agree with. Bizzleby also noted, I'm a weapons hoarder. JD commented, same, I'm afraid to use my weapons because they will break. And then like a worried emoticon. Bizzleby, I love changing things up mid-combat. I also did hoard like my weapons I loved, like especially the elemental like fire, ice, and electric weapons.
Once I got to Hyrule Castle though,
utility.
Once I got to Hyrule Castle and once I had the Master Sword, it was kind of just like, I was a little less afraid to like use the super good ones.
Yeah, I would agree there. So I want to also briefly mention, you do get some cool new abilities from your guardian friends every time you clear a guardian beast. I thought that was a cool way to change up combat. It certainly...
Oh, Mipha's Grace was the saving grace.
Oh, yeah, totally. The memory system in the game, something I've seen a lot of people talk about, but I view as a tremendous strength as a method for delivering the story in a way that the player sort of engages the pace.
Instead of forcing you to say, hey, Link, go here, hey!
Yeah, right? And I also really like that, you know, that's how you unlock the true ending of the game, is by getting all of the memories throughout your adventure. It gives you a really cool story sequence at the very, very end of the game that implies the direction the DLC may be going in.
I can't wait.
Where Zelda picks up her interest in Sheikah technology, and it appears is going to become an archaeologist into that technology. And
yes!
I'm super excited. I hope that that is a focus of the DLC, because if it is, I'm going to be screaming the whole time. The one last thing I wanted to note is the Koroks, which we have mentioned here a little bit. The Koroks are Koroks. You're probably familiar with the race from Wind Waker, but there are hundreds of them all over the game world map, and they all have these cute little emergent puzzles for you to solve. Like, sometimes it's like, oh, pop all the balloons that are floating around. Sometimes it's, oh, find me in this area 3 or 4 times. Sometimes it's like, oh, I'm hiding in the bushes, and you're going to have to find where the bushes are sparkling and cut it down around me. To me, that added a lot.
There was one for me where I had to use magnesis on a ball and chain and put it in a hole in a hollowed-out trunk.
Yeah, and I found stuff like that just really cute. Made the game world very interesting, because I feel like, despite the fact that the game world is massive, you are never more than, like, 10 seconds away from something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, from a design standpoint, is just a remarkable triumph. That having been said, we've talked about the story, we've talked about pacing, we've talked about the flow, we've talked a little bit about our emergent experiences. I think all that's left is to summarize. Overall, what are your positives, negatives, and overall feelings on Breath of the Wild, Slaggy?
I mean, I can't really think of too many negatives.
I have heard a lot of people complain about the technical hitches. You know, the game does have some questionable frame rate issues.
They have
been patched to be much better, but yeah. In the version of the game day one, for example, the Korok Forest, the game would straight up, it would feel like it was locking up. The frame rate was so bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of visually going on in the Korok Forest. I can see that, but no, I mean, I would say that this is pretty much a near-flawless game. I enjoyed every moment I had with it, and even when there were moments of frustration, it was never to the point where there were some times where I'm like, okay, I'm going to take a break and then take a stab at this later, but there was never anything that made me so, like, pissed off that I was going to, like, throw my Joy-Con grip across the room or something or whatever, but I think it's extremely compelling game. The characters are great. The puzzles are great. The combat's a lot of fun. And I think it really rings true to the original Zelda game, of just that idea of, like, you know, in Zelda 1, you could go out as long as you have bombs, and you could go get all the heart containers that you can find out in the open world, aside from the one that you need, like, the ladder and the raft for. You can do dungeons out of order. I would always go and do Dungeon 7 before Dungeon 6, because Dungeon 6 is the one with all the whiz robes, and it's fucking hard. And that level of freedom is something that I felt, starting with Link to the Past, was taken away from the player. And
well, let's be real. It kind of started with Adventure of Link Zelda 2.
Well, yeah, but
which
I mean,
has a very, very linear structure. I love that game. I absolutely adore it. But it did kind of bring linearity into the Zelda formula.
Right. And I mean, this really is the adventure that, you know, I've been waiting for 30 years.
We have your enzyme noting, even patched, it still hitches here and there regarding the game's technical performance. That is a true statement. It isn't nearly as bad as it used to be. It is like a night and day difference in some areas, but it is still not perfect. Absolutely needs to be said. Your enzyme also notes, I need to play Breath of the Wild with a little frowny face. That for me is my springboard into my review, which is that if you asked me, I would never have expected to call a modern Zelda game one of my favorite games of all time. Without question, Breath of the Wild is in my top 10. No modern Zelda game has ever really clicked for me since Ocarina of Time. I have a lot of appreciation for them. I enjoy them, but it's always been, I like this with a bullet, and then that bullet is a essay of problems I have with each game.
Yeah,
with this game, that is simply a non-issue. I love nearly every facet of this game. I am eager for more. I'm doing a completionist 100% run. Like, I ain't got time for that, but I'm doing it. If that doesn't tell you how much this game jived for me, I don't know what does.
I mean, I think the thing for me is that this really is, like, the new pillar of what Zelda is for me. Like, you know, for up until that, everything was just kind of trying to take what Ocarina did and add some little twists. But, like, I mean, this is, and I would always go back and say, you know, Ocarina is a special game because, you know, the way that the puzzles and the story and the characters and music all came together and just was a really special experience. Like, I mean, this overtakes Ocarina for me in every way. And, I mean, that's a tough thing to do because Ocarina of Time, this is the game that finally makes it show its age for me. Like, truly, truly.
So Bizzleby notes, Breath of the Wild is satisfying for players and sets a new standard for what we can expect in the future.
Well
and
said.
I want to tie what Bizzleby said and what you said together because you both sort of remark, you know, moving forward, this is the new standard. And, you know, Aonuma-san actually agrees. He has stated future games in the Zelda franchise will be made in the open-air mold. And quite teasingly and compellingly for me, he has stated that they already have ideas that he believes will make for a better game than Breath of the Wild.
And I can't even imagine that, but...
Right? To which I just say, bring it on, bro.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't see that as a, oh, now this is going to be the Ocarina problem where it's... Because, I mean, there's just so much possibility. And the funny thing is that, like, I care a lot about this Hyrule. And, like, I want to see kind of, like, what's next. I wouldn't even mind a sequel or, you know, a spinoff area or so showing some of the areas from Zelda 2 or whatever.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Can I also say, in a weird way, this made me, for the first time, appreciate the weird Zelda timeline where every Zelda is a descendant of the other Zelda. I used to hate that and just be like, no, they're just all legends, you know, mythology about, you know, this world of Hyrule, but... Like, this is the first time I'm like, okay, the way that they told the story and having it be this cycle that repeats, like, really finally made sense for me.
Excellent. Well, let's finish this discussion now, by which, in saying, the discussion is now over, and begin winding down by talking about what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
All right, so this week I have been playing Samurai Showdown 4. As noted, came out on the Switch eShop. I've been really enjoying revisiting it. I completely forgot, you know, when I think of Samurai Showdown, I typically think of those first two games, both of which I have on cartridge on Neo Geo, you know, really sort of set the foundation for the game. Samurai Showdown, by the time we get there, you know, it's introduced, like, the slash and bust versions of each character, where you get to, like, pick your character alignment and backstory, and it sort of affects your move list and everything and your damage attributes in the game, which means that every character is effectively two characters. I really dig that. It's a lot of fun. Slaggy, I'm really excited to show you Samurai Showdown 4, I gotta say.
Well, let's do that then.
Let's see, I also have been playing Overwatch, as I noted earlier. I'm really enjoying this current PvE event a lot. I've also gotten a lot of, like, legendary loot out of my loot boxes, which never normally happens. I'm really excited.
Do you have any of the sexy Blackwatch skins?
I have a couple of them, yeah. And, like, I have the D.Va selfie clip, which is super cool. The other game I've been playing a lot of is Snake Pass. Been playing it on Switch. The actual, like, visuals of the game, really good, you know, really does look nearly as good as the PS4 version. Of course, it's an Unreal Engine 4 game, which, as I've noted here since we learned about the Switch, it has native support for Unreal Engine 4, and it really shows in this game. Technically, it's fantastic. Unfortunately, for me at least, it's a little dull, it's a little cumbersome in the way it handles some of the collectible type stuff. Very much a game made in the mold of, like, the Rare 3D platformer collectathons.
But without the forward thing.
Well, I wouldn't call those games forward.
Well, I mean, about modernness.
I would say that they are, you know, they have, like, something special to them. They have a little, like, magic, and this game does not have that. See, it doesn't have that spark that keeps me interested.
When I said forward thinking, I meant, like, what you would expect from a Rare game taken to a 2017 place.
Let's see. Sulker here notes, you guys sing so well together live. Obviously, that was pre-recorded. Sulker also noted, when I was talking about Samurai Showdown, Samurai, why you're titty out, which is how we refer to a character in Overwatch. And then he summed up my review of Snake Pass as Snake Hard Pass.
Oh, boy.
Which is accurate. Slaggy, what have you been playing? Oh, last one. Been playing Persona 5. Saw a lot of stuff online, though, about like how very regressive the game is in its attitudes to LGBT people.
Yeah.
And how it even is taking a lot of steps back from LGBT representation in Persona 4. And that has me a little bit less enthused about the game. Like, I just am not as motivated to play through it knowing that this reductive and even damaging representation exists in the game. So, you know, I get attitudes about LGBT in Japan. You ain't gotta tell me that. But while I can completely appreciate stuff like in-game quizzes, in-classrooms, tests and pop quizzes questioning you about Japanese culture because it's a game set in Japan, at the same time, people making this game, like, even if those anti-LGBT attitudes exist in Japan, you don't have to reflect it in your art, girl. So that for me is a real struggle, and I'm sure I'll get over it at some point, but given that I had hopes for Persona 5 in that regard, very disappointed to hear that the ball was dropped, or, you know, just that they chose to treat it that way.
Yeah.
Slaggy, what about you? What have you been
playing? I mean, that's tough, because I am playing Persona 5 knowing full well that that content's coming, but the game is so good. Like, it takes everything that I liked about, you know, the previous Personas. And, I mean, I think Persona 4 is always going to be my favorite. It's a very special game. The characters are very likable in that game. But so far, I'm really enjoying it. And I love that there's, like, negotiations from Shin Megami Tensei that you can negotiate with the demons. And so, like, I mean, that's a really cute way to tie that in. I've only finished the first dungeon, and I'm, like, 10 hours in. So I can see why it's a huge, you know, 100-plus hour affair, and I'm hoping that the somewhat problematic content is not going to detract from the quality of the game. Other than that, you know, I've been spending time with Breath of the Wild, and I finished Night in the Woods, which I have a lot of strong feelings about. A lot of people are hesitant to pick that game up because there's not a lot in terms of gameplay. It's a very light platformer, but, I mean, very, very lightly so, but it's very much story-based, but, I mean, it covers themes of, you know, being the only queer people in a small town where, you know, you don't see other people like yourself. It has themes of, like, mental illness and, you know, just kind of, like, depression and just, like, the ennui of being a 20-something in a small town coming back from college, which I can definitely relate to. And, you know, so for people who are just like, oh, it's cute animals, it's a furry game, you know, with a cute art style, there's a lot more to it. I would say that in a lot of ways, it reminded me of a lot of the things I really loved about Oxenfree, but with a little bit less of the puzzling elements that Oxenfree did really well. I still think it's definitely worthwhile for anyone who is into that sort of, like, you know, narrative-based game. And it's just something really special. So, you know, definitely something that I would recommend.
Excellent.
Even for you, and I know that you've been hesitant to pick it up because there's not a lot of gameplay. But like I said, I know you like Oxenfree a lot. So, I mean, you might get a lot out of it.
All right. Well, let's start wrapping this show up and go to our social links.
Yeah, as everyone always, we love your feedback. I want to take this opportunity to thank those of you who have been with us in chat today, Sulker, Your Enzyme, JD, and Bisselbee. Thank you so much for joining us live. We love coming to you live, and we love your feedback. We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. Also, Google Play and Stitcher Radio, if you tune into us there. And thanks for joining us on Mixlr, where we do our live episodes and chat. You can interact with us on Facebook and Twitter. We effing love Twitter.
Tweet
at us, please. And if you want to email us, you can mail us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org. And our home base is GameBuoy.org, where all 135 of these puppies are.
Where all 135 of these puppies are.
That's a lot of puppies. With that, it's time for our shoutouts.
Wait, did we not do social links?
Well, our social links were the chat today.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a good point. All right. Well, then, as ever and always, I want to point you in the direction of the Voice of Geeks Network, which can be found over at vognetwork.com. I want to start, of course, by shouting out a few shows on Vogue along with us. That is, of course, like Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO, and Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal so many of my cues, especially on a live episode like today. You can also hear me on Vogue over on the Ranger Pride cast, where myself and Shayna Lenko talk about the current season of the Power Rangers meta series, as well as the current season of the Super Sentai meta series upon which it's based out of Japan. You can also check out the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. Not on Vogue, but still worth your attention, would be Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin. And their sister show X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. Last, but probably also least, is Slagkick's show Reading is Fundamental.
Fuck you, bitch.
Why don't you
sit down and shut the fuck up?
We just heard that explicit tag. So that is, of course, Slagkick's show focusing on the current season of RuPaul's Drag Race, featuring myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, Delvin from VG Realness, and Slagkick, as mentioned. And, you know, while I razz him and I give him a hard time both here and on that show, I actually have a lot of fun with it. And I'm always looking forward to recording the next episode. I can't wait until we talk about last night's Drag Race on this week's Reading is Fundamental.
Oh my god, right.
Slaggy, why don't you take us to a game bar?
Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion, and a part of the Hunty Bunch, along with Video Game Realness, serving up a dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, joystick jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them and their LGBTQ QTs, and our allies over at the Nintendo Phone Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk. I'd also like to steer you in the direction of our sister shows. First up is our sister ship over at the SS Anime Buoy, which is your monthly protocol for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. And our same type attack bonus, Stabcast.org podcast, which is our Pokemon podcast with Sulker, who is here in chat with us today. And that is your twice-monthly look into the deeper worlds of Pokemon. Our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They forever closed their doors a while back, but we will forever be pouring out of 40 into the Great Fairy Fountain, or maybe Lake Hylia, where all of the Zoras can get hyphy.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us here today. It has been an absolute pleasure to do this live episode for and with you all today. I want to give a special big ups to those of you who spent your Saturday afternoon listening to us live. You know, I know that Slaggy just thanked y'all, but I have to say again, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Obviously, we always spend our time this weekend doing this, but for all y'all out there to do it is just absolutely touching, and I deeply appreciate it. We will be back at you in another week or two with more of our left-of-center news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. But until then, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And see you, Space Cowboy. I haven't played the music yet. You need to make another comment.
Hey, listen. I'm surprised we got to that whole discussion. We didn't talk about how everyone wants to fuck all of them. Characters.
Right? You didn't talk about like crazy shark or tunics.
Or birds in their clothing.
Your enzyme notes that we're talking over our outro music. We do know that.
Sulker says we can hear you. We know.
All right, just real quick, Your Enzyme says, thank you, Spike and Slaggy. You're totally welcome, but honestly, thank you, man. Sulker notes, great show, guys. Thank you so, so much. JD comments, OMG, last night, yas. Obviously a reference to last night's episode of Drag Race. Slagkick, I don't know who the hell this basic bitch is, says, OMG, Sentai is so good. In response to Your Enzyme saying, I tried listening to Ranger Pride, but I don't know what you were talking about. other than the new Power Rangers movie, of course. I'm a big fan of the new Power Rangers movie. I thought it was super good, but it needs to be said, the current season of Super Sentai, which is Q-Ranger, super good, which which Sidekick and Sulker both reference, Sulker with OQ and Sidekick with that song reference there. The notes on people talking over the closing song. We have Sulker noting gross slag, gross,
okay,
which is accurate.
So cloacas are too much for you, but two dick sharks are not. Okay.
Your enzyme pointing out talking about bird genitalia, which, yeah, I mean, the way people thirst after the Guardians and Zelda, even the anthropomorphic animal men have their genitals talked about. And wrapping this up, your enzyme asks, where can I watch it?
Presumably Sentai and not bird genitalia.
Well, so the answer to that is that the fan subbing group Overtime is subbing Q-Ranger. You can find it online. You can find it streaming over on Kiss Anime. I'm not usually into those kinds of sites, but in this case, this is obviously not something that's been licensed for American release, so it's kind of the only way to get to it. People now talking about Prince Sidon, which is, I think, a good for us to wrap up.
It's not Sidon? I've thought because it would be Shidon. Right,
so it actually would be Shidon. I just didn't want to get into all that right this moment.
See, usually you're the one who does get into it, though.
Well, shut up. All right, guys, thank you so much. JD notes the best part of Zelda is when you get to ride him.
And I said hamster eating banana dot gif.
You y'all too much. All right, guys, thank you again. This is the end of our bloopers for this week. Take care, have a good time, take care of yourselves and each other.
I'm hungry.
Me too.